We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
And welcome to In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All
pelicans.
All the time.
Welcome to the show. In just a few days, the draft will be over. The Pelicans will have a brand new player. And we'll be gearing up for free agency, but we're not here to talk about free agents. We're here to finally talk about the draft and what our big boards look like. Michael, you excited?
I am. I know people are in pins and needles waiting for what our hypothetical or what our big boards look like when we have absolutely no impact in the decision making. But this is what we'll get to point to 3 years later and say how smart we are, or just pretend like we never made these statements this week.
That's right.
When the guys atop our board bust,
we'll have a database failure, and suddenly those posts will be gone. So I'm excited, but before we get to the actual big board, there are rumors flying around like there is every year. This, I don't know. To me, it seems like I'm getting a little bit more rumors than like there were the past couple of years. I'm guessing that's probably because the quality of this draft isn't so high, so people are seeing what they can do and move around and maybe grab one of those top two or three guys they think are actually really solid.
I mean, got to remember where rumors come from. I mean, the ones that are legit, you know, they're basically GMs talking to writers, hoping that they float this stuff out, you know, for a reason. I mean, a GM isn't just going to talk to a writer out of good faith to give the guy a break, to help him with his job. I mean, everybody has a motive and everything in life. So these things get out there because GMs or whoever want them out there. So we got to keep that in mind. And I think it's one of those things where normally in a draft, GMs at this time know what kind of value each guy has. I don't think they have any clue right now. I think Orlando's sitting there going, all right, this week, let's say we're taking Oladipo and see what kind of offers we get for the pick then. Oh, no, nothing. All right, well, let's say we're taking Trey Burke. Let's see who's fallen in love with him, seeing if we could get somebody to trade up because they're afraid he'll be off the board. I mean, I think that's a big part of what's going on here.
Yeah, I agree. Although the one team that I can't figure out for the life of me, I have no idea what Cleveland's doing. I mean, they're just... They have like this really weird rumor mill going on, but it's not generated by them. It doesn't seem like I can't figure out the rumors that come out of them are like from such strange people too. It just doesn't make sense to me. I have not any clue if anything I've heard about Cleveland is accurate at all or not.
So let me ask you, does that make it more fun for you, or would you like to know right about now the top three or four in this draft, like we do probably this time of year most years?
Well, if it's top three or four, I'm fine with that. But actually, I kind of enjoy not knowing, because then there's a chance that something might slide to me that will make me really excited. So I can, like, turn... Like, last year, honestly, I turned it on, and I knew I was getting Anthony Davis, and the rest of it was just gravy from that point. And I couldn't even be, like, really mad when they took Austin Rivers, partially because I thought they were going to take him because you'd convinced me, partially because, you know, I already had Anthony Davis. But I kind of like having this uncertainty, like what might be available at six. Am I going to get, you know, a present with like something wonderful inside or a turd sandwich?
Yeah, I mean, but just overall, as a Pelicans fan, you're right. But overall, just the drama with this week, you know, the possible people to be traded. We saw the Doc Rivers domino fall today. How does that impact the rest of the Celtics? Is Pierce out next? You know, Garnett, is Rajon Rondo possibly on the block? Do they blow it all up? Do they go the other way? Do they say, no, you know, we want to win this year, and they go out and acquire somebody else? So that domino dropped, plenty more could drop between now and Thursday or on Thursday. And I think it's just, I think it's fun overall. And it was kind of fun this week. We saw, you know, we thought workouts were pretty much over with, although Dell just said he had nothing scheduled. He didn't say he was done. All of a sudden, these trade rumors start, or sorry, these whispers start with Orlando starting to lock in on Trey Burke. And all of a sudden, it seems like because of that, or maybe in small part because of that, Dell Demps hops a plane, goes out to Washington to watch Oladipo work out, scheduled Ben McLemore to come in this week so he could have an interview with him. So it seems like you know, Dell didn't believe that either of those guys would be there at six, and now with Trey Burke possibly going to two, honestly, if he does, I would say 90-95% chance that one of those two guys are there, which makes this week even that much more interesting.
If either of those guys makes it to number six, people who are drafting, there's got to be at least a couple idiots, which isn't surprising because these are the GMs who are the lower rungs of the playoff ladder. I don't know. If either Oladipo or McLemore are there, I'll be over the moon, either one of them.
So I obviously have my opinion on this. When Oladipo or McLemore to the Pelicans is even discussed, I get this question conservatively 40 times. If it happens, I'll get it 300 times on draft night. So I'll just ask you, if the Pelicans take one of those two guys, does that mean Eric Gordon is gone?
No. No, I mean, I think Dell is already trying to get rid of Eric Gordon, but he's not getting rid of him for nothing. And so basically he's just going to look around and see what kind of deals he can get. So if he can't get a great deal, he'll keep him, and then he'll play these guys off the ball. I mean, they're rookies. There's no reason – you don't have any requirement that they get huge minutes just because they were, you know, sixth pick in the draft. You can play them behind somebody. You can play them at small forward. You can play them at shooting guard. Both of these guys work that way. So I would not say that just because they pick these guys that, honestly, the chance that Gordon is gone has increased at all. Not even a little bit. Do you agree or disagree?
Yeah, see, I mean, people probably think that we pre-plan these podcasts beforehand and make sure that we agree or pick fights to disagree on. We don't say anything. It's just as big of a surprise to the listeners as it is to me when you say it. And honestly, if you didn't say what you said, I would have said the exact same thing. I mean, 2 points. One, did we not just watch the Spurs and the Heat play three guard lineups most, if not all, of that final series? I mean, the Spurs were most effective when they went, when they inserted Ginobili, when Parker, Ginobili, Green. The Heat had LeBron, three shooters, and Birdman. That was their best lineups. I mean, so first of all, you know, the guys all can play together. Second of all, I hear people saying, well, there'd be a log jam at small forward. You got to get rid of it. You have one guy who's played about 25% of games the last 2 years. You have another guy who's coming off of one of the historically worst seasons of all time. And you have a third guy who's never played a minute in the NBA. Where is the logjam of these great players? No, I mean, honestly, I understand if they all reach their potential, then yes, we will have three guys who on the program, their position says shooting guard, who are all top 10 picks and who are all young. I understand that. What do we have right now? We have, like I just said, a shooting guard that plays a quarter of the games the last 2 years, another guy who's, you know, one of the worst players in the NBA last year, and a rookie. So, no, I agree with you. If Dell's going to move Gordon, he's going to move Gordon. If he's going to hold on to him, he's going to hold on to him. But it has nothing to do with whatever 19- or 20-year-old we pick in the next couple of days. That doesn't factor in the least.
Now, I will say, Gordon's level of whininess will be impacted by whatever we pick, as we've seen last year. But at this point, can it really get any more annoying?
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, I think he learned his lesson from that one. I wouldn't doubt that behind closed doors, he might be whining or upset, but, you know, I don't think we see anything in the media because honestly, he doesn't have the leverage. I mean, he whined last year. Think about it, you know, from his perspective. Last year, you know, he had a team come at him and tell him he was the greatest thing ever, plop down more money than he's ever seen in his life in front of him. He was feeling pretty good about himself. Flash forward to now, I'm sure he knows, you know, nobody's willing to give up a ham sandwich for him in a trade. And, you know, he had his worst season. I mean, even in the games he played, he had his worst season on the court since he's been in the league. So, you know, as bitter as he might be if we take a quote-unquote shooting guard, I don't really think he has any leverage. He doesn't have any power in order to whine and force his way out.
Yeah. Yeah, so here's the question, though. Do you care? I mean, we're going to kind of get into this, into the tier discussions, but let's say somehow we had a player on the board who would fit in at small forward or point guard, and McLemore is there. So it's Porter or either Oladipo or McLemore. Do you take one of those guys because you like the fit better, or are you one of the ones who just take the better guy?
I always take the better guy, and because my thing is that whoever we take on Thursday will not hit their prime or be the best version of themselves for 5-6 years. We don't have anybody under contract for 5 or 6 years. So I know people think about drafting this guy for today. I honestly draft him for the player that I think he could be in 5 or 6 years. And since nobody is under contract for that time, how can I draft somebody, you know, and say that I'm drafting them for fit when I'm not really inserting the best version of them into the puzzle for 5 or 6 years, and I have no clue what other pieces I'll have? So that's why I always go best player available. I mean, if this were, you know, 20 years ago, and we were drafting, you know, 22-year-old guys, or if everybody in the draft coming out was as polished as Duncan was coming out, then, yeah, I would draft for need. But these guys we're drafting now, we're not going to see, you know, the best of them until they hit that second contract. So how can I draft for fit when I have no clue what that team 5 years ago will need?
Okay. Well, then let's go on to this, to our next subject, which is the tiers. So there is the idea out there that some GMs use, and Chad Ford of ESPN.com, the draft guy, likes to use the same thing, where he says basically players fit into a tier, where you say these five guys are the best talent or the second best tier of talent, and if you have one of these guys available in tier one, it doesn't matter if the best guy in tier two fits a need. You should always take that guy in tier one, even if there's no way that guy will probably even see the floor for you because you've already filled that position. So for you, do you care about the tiers, or do you really rank them as this is the best guy, period, and I don't care about, you know, who else is in the tier?
Yeah, I would go best guy, period. The one thing I will say that I do care about fit-wise is personality fit. So, you know, we heard during the finals, I forget if it was Magic or Jalen Rose, but, you know, they talked about how the Spurs as an organization, they always say to themselves, is this guy a Spur? Meaning, is this a guy that's willing to sacrifice me for we, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I need to know that guy is a fit for my culture and what I'm trying to build in the locker room. So that does matter for me as far as fit. But I mean, as far as tiers, I guess I would group guys into tiers for value, you know, especially if I was looking to trade up or trade down. Like, I think when we get into our tiers, I personally have four guys in my first tier in this draft. And that's for this draft. I'm not saying they're top tier relative to every draft ever. I'm just saying in this draft, there's four guys that stand out to me on a little higher level than the next tier. So I would put them into tiers just for purposes of thinking about trading up or trading down. Like if I had the sixth pick and there were seven guys in my second tier, I would feel comfortable trading down to 11 or 12, but I wouldn't, you know, it would take a lot for me to trade down to 15. So I would put them in for that respect. But when it's time to pick, I would throw the tiers away and strictly take the top guy on my board.
Makes sense. Yeah. So basically I kind of lump my guys in tiers and then I'd pick for need. So that may not be the smartest thing in the world, but the way I feel pretty comfortable doing that, and you'll see how that works out and when we hit our big boards.
So Chad Ford did have his tiers, and again, his tiers are, well, tier one is, you know, pretty much a sure thing, a guy who, if he stays injury-free, is likely to be a perennial all-star. Tier two is a guy with the potential to be an all-star, you know, at the very least, a very, very good starter. He didn't have anybody. Well, okay, I should clarify this. It's not Chad Ford. Chad Ford talks to GMs, asks the GMs to put guys in the tiers, and there was really nobody, no GMs that came back and said that, you know, there was tier one or tier two guys. As far as a consensus, there was a couple of GMs who put a couple of guys into tier two, but really no consensus tier one or two tier two players. There was six tier three players, again, guys who are starters, maybe quasi all-stars, maybe think, you know, Josh Howard, think made an all-star team, Jameer Nelson, guys like that. In that group, he had six guys: Nerlens Noel, Ben McLemore, Oladipo, Porter, Bennett, and Alex Len. Now, the Pelicans happen to be drafting sixth. I mean, do you think this is a good thing, you know, for the Pelicans, that at least the consensus among GMs is that there is a top six in this draft?
Yes, that's a good thing for the Pelicans. However, if you look at any of my historical evaluations of the draft, one of the top five always busts. Always. So, I mean, where do you go with that? There's a general consensus that, you know, there are six guys that are pretty good. So that's got to be comforting that we should probably end up with one of them. But, of course, you'll notice that Trey Burke and Michael Carter-Williams aren't in that top six. And those are two of the few guys who would come and work out for Dell. At least up until this recent thing with McLemore and Oladipo, which I think is more telling about the agents than necessarily with Dell. I would be shocked if Dell didn't want to meet with those guys beforehand. But the fact that the agents are letting it happen is very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that they're doing that because they're starting to get some word that their client slipping is a real possibility, which is really interesting. But you look at those teams, I don't see Cleveland's not taking a shooting guard, I don't think. Washington's not. I know a lot of people think that Charlotte might, but man, that is one of the worst front lines, if not it's probably the worst front line in the NBA. They've got to take a big there. So you're looking at 2 and 5, and I think in almost every mock draft you could go back and one of those guys went at 2 and one went at 5. You throw Trey Burke in at 2, or Phoenix falls in love with somebody else at 5, or Orlando could if Alex Len goes first, Orlando could take Nerlens Noel second, and then there goes another landing spot for one of those shooting guards. I really think more and more that one of these two guys are going to be available. And getting back to, your other point on one of the top five always busts, I think GMs just need to call you and I, because one of those top six guys in Chad Ford's third tier there, you and I, neither of us even have him in the top 10. So I think we know who that guy is.
Well, actually, he is number 10 for me.
Oh, you put him at 10? You're soft. well, then combined aggregate is he's about 15th because I have him 19th on my board. But
right, yeah. When I look at tier 4, I have the same thing. Like, one of these guys does not belong. Good. I mean, how is Steven Adams? It's the Myers-Leonard effect, but. It's still, how do they do this every year? How does someone do this?
I think he actually benefits by Andre Drummond. I mean, Andre Drummond put up bad college stats. He fell, and now a lot of GMs regret it. I really think that people are afraid of making another Drummond mistake, and for some reason they see Steven Adams more like Drummond than they see, Dejana Diop or the countless other big men who were drafted based on potential in that 8 to 12 range that we see every year. Rafael Araujo I mean, we could sit here forever. Ser Sene. We could go.
Patrick O'Brien.
We could go on and on and on.
Hilton Armstrong, Cedric Simmons.
Oh, bringing up painful memories. But yeah, I mean, again, this is not Chad Ford's opinion. This is the consensus he got amongst GMs. I like the fact that, you're picking in the top six in a draft where other GMs believe that there's a consensus top pick, not only for us and our ability to keep that pick, but if, you do put it on the trade market, and this is something that Jerry V says that he thinks the Pelicans have a lot of interest in, something that you would love to see Dell do is trade this pick. If there is a top six, then that means that one of those guys is going to be on the board. If Trey Burke goes number two, two of those guys will be on the board when you pick, and that just gives that pick that much more value than if, say, you were picking eight in a six person draft. So, I like the fact that the GMs at least seem to believe that and the Pelicans look like they're in a position to get one of those top six guys, but that's their list. It's time finally for you and I to unveil our big boards. We're going to do this as a huge piece on Tuesday, but for those of you who listen to the podcast, you're lucky you get to hear first. Actually, all the writers from our site are going to be putting up their big board, so you'll get to see them all. But you'll hear Ryan and I's first. Let's start with your tier three guys. Let's start tier three and work our way up. Again, this is not tier three relative to all drafts. This is just we did our tier ones, twos, and threes relative to this draft only. So talk to me about the guys in your tier three and why.
Well, really, I only have two guys in the top 10 who are part of my tier three. So those who I'm going to talk about. I have Anthony Bennett and Caldwell Pope and Kentavious. I'm assuming that's how you say that first name.
you got one right.
Did I really? I'm proud of myself. So those are my, and I feel for some reason when I look at Caldwell Pope, I feel like for some reason I should like him more, but I can't love him. So he's a tier three guy for me. I think we agree on that one.
Yeah, we had him in the same exact spot. He's ninth on both of our big boards, and he's in my tier three as well. I mean, he's a guy that, again, if we traded back or were able to pick up another pick, I don't know. I'm not in love. I wouldn't be ecstatic. I see him fairly similar to Terrence Ross coming out last year. I think he's got to put on some weight, but he's got a nice shot. He's athletic. He could actually rebound fairly well. My concern with him is just really his ability to finish with contact at the rim. Like, I think he's 2 or 3 years away from really being a starting caliber shooting guard. So he's not somebody that, you know, I'd be miserable with if somehow, you know, either we traded back or picked up another pick later on in the draft. But again, I go to my test of, you know, if Minnesota takes this guy or Oklahoma City takes this guy, am I really that scared? And the answer is no. So, you know, I just can't fall in love with him. But he's there almost by default in a fairly weak draft.
Yeah, I mean, so certain of his numbers are nice. I like his steals numbers. I like his rebounding numbers a lot. But he was also the primary ball handler for Georgia, and he did most of the work for them. And he only drew 5 free throws a game, and took a lot of three-pointers, which he hit at a nice clip, but they're college three-pointers, and he wasn't that great in a catch-and-shoot. And if there's no way this is going to be the guy who's going to be generating our offense. It's just not going to happen next year. So I would rather have a guy who could mesh with an existing offense a little more than what I think he can do right off the bat.
Yeah, so I've got to ask you about Anthony Bennett, because there's not – mm-hmm. There's not one guy in this draft that's realistically in our range that makes me wake up with cold sweats more. I mean, so first tell me what you like, and then tell me your reservations, because you have to have some if he's at 10.
Yeah, so I like Bennett's general offensive skill set. He's a good shooter. He's got a nice mid-range post-up game, and I think that's something we see recently, that the most deadly guys offensively, LeBron James now gets that shot at the elbow or the mid-range. Dirk Nowitzki does it. Kevin Durant does it. If you can do that, if you can receive and be a threat from that range, you could be pretty effective, and I think he could do that. My reservations, he's not particularly a good rebounder. His steals and block numbers are abysmal. And if anybody in this draft is a candidate for the Michael Sweetney turn into a Stay Puft Marshmallow award, it's Anthony Bennett. The dude makes me think he's just going to get paid and get fat.
Yeah, he's got those chubby cheeks. I'm always... Yeah.
It's not just his cheeks. I mean... I've seen these highlight reels, and it looks like, you know, he and Boris Diaw could you know, have a little competition going.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I could see that. My biggest concern, I mean, the defense to me is abysmal, but I'm not going to really argue that, because Then I'll have the Monty worshippers come back and say that, you know, Monty will make them play good defense. You know, whatever. That's for another day, another time, even though I saw Monty give up on a guy named Marcus Thornton because, you know, he couldn't get him to do that. My biggest problem is this is a guy who the last 3 years, this year, the 2 years before that, at the end of the season, had big injuries that required surgery. He was playing against high schoolers, prep ball, and then he was playing, against college players. In 30, 35 game seasons, this guy can't keep from getting injured. And I mean, and we're not just talking about twisting an ankle. We're talking about fairly major injuries. If there is a guy in this draft that is going to frustrate fan bases the way that Eric Gordon has, where you see the potential when he plays, but he's in a suit way more than he's in a jersey, it's clearly Anthony Bennett. Like, you could go through, if you went through everybody's injury file in this draft, I mean, it's not even close. People have reservations about Noel, but Bennett's is far worse. I just, you know, we could talk about all the talent in the world, but if the guy is in a suit and, you know, in your opinion, an extra large suit, he's not going to help any team out. So that's why he's 19th on my board. If you could make it NBA 2K14, shut the injuries off, he'd be around 9 or 10 for me too. But I just, there's no way I could take him in the lottery knowing that he's probably going to be another guy who misses 30 games a year at minimum.
Right. So instead you have MCW, and he doesn't make my list, my top 10 at all. What do you see about Carter Williams that you really like, that you think he's deserving of a top 10 pick?
Yeah, again, I mean, he's behind Caldwell Pope, who I said I wasn't even in love with, so... Again, this is almost by default. It was really hard for me to put a 10th guy in there. What I like about Carter Williams is, at the very least, the potential to be a ball hawk on defense. I still don't buy in to him even being an average offensive player in his prime, but I could see, what if you got a taller, longer Avery Bradley? Just on defense. I mean, I don't think that Carter Williams will even ever be able to develop the corner three that Bradley has. But, you know, in this draft at 10, would you take a taller, longer Avery Bradley on defense?
Absolutely.
Right. I think it's possible. I mean, he has the length, he has the wingspan, all of his agility, whatever numbers were absolutely through the roof. Some of the things he said when asked about playing the zone at Syracuse made a lot of sense. Like, we think of a zone as lazy. Theirs really isn't. I mean, his points were that in man-to-man, when you're off the ball, sometimes you just get to rest and do nothing.
Right.
You can't in a zone. You have to know a lot of principles. You have to always be moving. When a guy sets a pick, you can't just rely on the switch or drop back. You've got to fight through it. So I think a lot of people lazily just say, oh, he played a zone, he's probably bad at on defense, when in reality, every young player who comes in the league is bad on defense.
Right.
So I really think that you have the potential to have that kind of player, and if I could get that at 10, I would get that, but I have little to no faith whatsoever in his offense.
Right. So I understand where you're going with all that. And I could, I had him a little higher until I was looking at some of his other numbers. And when it comes out that on 28% of his pick and roll possessions, he turned the ball over, and his in the half court, he is one of the worst points per possession. He only scores 0.6 points per possession in the half court. The NBA is a half-court game. It's nice for everybody to always say, well, you can get out and run, and he's pretty good when he gets out and run. But in the NBA, there isn't a lot of getting out and running. And in the playoffs, there is even less getting out and running. So if you're reliant on that to do any sort of efficient scoring, and even if you're good at that, you're still an awful efficiency because you can't do anything in the half-court, I can't get behind you being on my team. So
yeah, and I'm going to bring this up with our podcast guest, who's a big fan of Michael Carter Williams a little later. People talk about all his length and how, you know, that's more appealing than somebody like Trey Burke. But if you have the length, but it doesn't help you with what size and length should help you with, then it doesn't matter. And you brought up some numbers about him in the half court. The scariest one for me is how does a guy that tall finish at just 48.8% at the rim in the half court?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody says they want a bigger point guard. Well, it's usually because they could go into the paint, handle, whatever. You know, Tony Parker leads the league amongst guards every year. I think he was second this year, but almost every other year he's first in points in the paint. He's not the tallest guy in the world. You know, Trey Burke is shorter, but he's much better. McCollum's much better at the rim, finishing at the rim than Michael Carter Williams. So, again, Michael Carter Williams has these things that are all great in theory, but you look at the number and his height did not help him finish at the rim at all. So what's the point of having this trait if it doesn't if it doesn't help you do things better than guys who are smaller than you? So
yeah. So you want to move on to our tier two guys?
Yeah, I do. I just, what does that say about this draft when we're bashing guys in our top 10?
Well, I mean, last year we did the same thing. Like last year, were you excited about Terrence Ross or Jeremy Lamb?
No.
Austin Rivers?
But,
I mean,
but I would say there was 10 because I was excited about John Henson and, you know, Kendall Marshall, who actually did do well towards the end of the year. But okay, so let's move up to our tier two. I'll go first this time. I had four guys in this.
By the way, I'm offended by this tier two.
Okay.
At least one member of it.
I had four guys in it. And please do not, use this against me. We did the six pick tournament. We're all professional writers. You know, what we believe or do not believe, throw out the window. Our job is to put the information out there. I know I've been pounding Otto Porter because I've been representing him in the six pick tournament. I have him in my tier two, fifth overall. So I have Porter fifth, Len 6th, Zeller 7th, and Trey Burke 8th. Those are my four tier 2 guys. Who do you got?
So I have the same number. I have 4. I have at number 4 Actually, Noel.
But okay.
What's that?
You have 5 tier 2 guys.
Oh, I'm not good at math here. Noel, McCollum, Burke, Zeller, and then Len, and that's the order that I have them in. So you'll notice a difference just right off the bat. I have Noel and McCollum in my tier two, and he has Porter taking their places. Otherwise, we agree on Len, Zeller, and Burke in slightly different orders. So I love me or Otto Porter. So explain yourself. How dare you put him as a tier two guy?
So again, I'm drafting for 5 or 6 years down the line. I love Otto Porter, love what he did at Georgetown. I love the skill set. I can't, with the four guys in my tier one, I could envision what would need to have, you know, a pathway that has them become multiple time all-stars, you know, 2, 3, 4 time all-stars in this league. I can't, as optimistic as I want to be about him, as much as I love him and his game, I can't imagine the scenario in which Otto Porter is a multiple time all-star. But that doesn't mean I don't think he'll be very good. Like, I don't think Kawhi Leonard's going to make multiple all-star games. And I firmly believe that if the Spurs win game 6 or game 7, he should have been the finals MVP. You can't talk me out of that. Like, defending the best player on the planet, I think he was the only guy in the series to average a double-double, straight consistency. I think Otto Porter could be that good. I don't think Kawhi Leonard's going to be a multiple-time All-Star. So it's just a ceiling thing for me where the guys in my tier one, I could see a way if they stay healthy and continue on a path that they all make multiple All-Star games. I can't with Porter. I mean, can you see Porter being a multiple-time All-Star?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I could see him be a better version of Hedo Turkoglu.
It's an interesting one.
And in which case you could end up, I mean, I'm not saying he's going to be like the perennial shoe-in All-Star, but I could see him getting in there as, you know, the second best player on a really solid team, getting in there 3-4 times across his career.
So you think he could be better than Josh Howard in his prime?
Yeah, I think that's another good comparison, but I think he's got a more natural offense than Josh Howard ever did.
Do you agree with me? Do you think Kawhi Leonard will be a multi-time All-Star?
I think that it depends on what happens with the Spurs. I think that it's really hard to be a multiple-time All-Star when you have three guys who have won it on your team all the time. But it wouldn't surprise me if he managed to snag two or three towards the end of Duncan's career if Duncan keeps going.
Yeah, I just... Okay, well...
On his own merits. So, like, let's say he went to a completely different team. He's not with the Spurs. So he comes to the Pelicans. Well, actually, Anthony Davis said that's not a good choice. He goes to Milwaukee. They're probably not, because no one's going to notice him. But if he can have, like, the David West, Chris Paul effect going on, where he's got a star next to him, and people are like, that star can't be carrying that team entirely on his own. So who's the second best player on that team? Oh, Leonard. Yeah, well, let's give him a few all-star appearances, because he's probably pretty good. Yeah, I think you could get that. And I think that's kind of what I'm saying with Porter, too. So
yeah,
on his merit, on his own personal merit, no, I don't think that Porter is likely to become a repeat all-star. But I absolutely believe, because he fills so many holes on the court, he does so many different things well for you, that you can very easily say he's definitely the second best player on this team, and it can be a very good team if he's your second best player.
So, yeah, I think you and I might, I don't know, maybe we do our boards differently. So I guess I'll ask you this. If everybody hits their potential, everybody hits their absolute ceiling in this draft, do you think Porter has the highest ceiling?
No.
Okay. So yeah, I think that's just where, and this is what's interesting. I mean, this is there's 30 teams in the NBA. There's probably GMs who think about this 30 different ways. I did it as, you know, if I'm really on the clock, if I'm picking first or second, and that pick in and of itself has an inherent value, can I just pick the solid guy? Or do I have to take a shot? Again, this is a league where only one team wins the championship. Like, 97% of fans are going to be miserable or upset at the end of the year. I mean, God, I woke up the next day just thinking, trying to put myself in the place of a Spurs fan. Like, that's a successful season, and you would be sick to your stomach.
Yeah.
So I guess my thinking is that, like, if I have a pick this high, I might never have it this high again. How can I take the double if, yeah, one of these home runs might be a strikeout, but I got to try. So I think it was just a little different. But what I'm curious about is you and I have Len and Zeller in this group, but we have them flip-flop. Tell me why you like Cody Zeller better than Alex Len.
Just because Zeller has shown it more than Len has. So here's my problem. Both of them are equally poor rebounders. But all the excuses for Len that he had bad guards and all of the tape I've seen of him, he does not have much of a power game. So he's basically a guy who's already proven he can't rebound. He's not that efficient of a scorer. He doesn't have a really strong power game. He can hit a hook shot every once in a while over a guy. Zeller gets the same negative things, but he's been way more capable of scoring, of still scoring and doing things with those same weaknesses. So in my book, Len and Zeller are almost the exact same, It's just that Zeller has developed a little bit further along the path. So why don't take the guy who I know can develop at least from point D to C and probably will continue to go rather than the guy who's still at D?
Yeah, I mean, it's a compelling case, and it's one.
And just let me jump. So, I mean, you were talking about before about like high ceilings. The way I kind of look at my picks is I kind of take a median between how I feel their ceiling and floor will be. And that's how I rank them. So, yeah, I could actually see someone like Noel, who I have in my tier two, being a monster Dikembe Mutombo defensive beast who you know, does really well. But I could also see him be completely useless, like an absolute bust. So for him, it's like he could be a 20, he could be 100. But, you know, when I take that to medium, I'm only getting a 60.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes total sense. And the farther I go down the draft, the more I would agree with that. Like, if I'm drafting at 1, 2, or 3, for me, I'm shooting for the hundreds or trying to hit the home runs. The further I go down the draft, I agree. I'm usually more somebody who's I'll take the solid double over trying for the triple. I guess the thing with me with Len and Zeller, I mean, the thing I'm just so terrified with Zeller is you just see time and time again that 7-footers with poor wingspans, just have problems finishing on offense.
Are you playing the wingspan card?
I really, yeah. I mean, it just makes, I mean, again, it just comes time and time again.
I was just today at the National Zoo with my kids.
Oh gosh.
And the bald eagle has an amazing wingspan and he's sitting there in a cage and he's endangered.
Yeah, but he's swatting every piece of food they throw at him. Yeah, I mean,
he's got a bunch of people caring for him all the time. Right.
He wants to be there. He's like the Joker. He wanted to be captured. He has some plan up his sleeve. But, I mean, it's just so close. Honestly, there's a lot of things that probably aren't, I'm not being fair to Zeller. One of which, I'll admit, I saw Tyler Zeller come in, have, you know, the same short wingspan last year. Yeah, he wasn't as athletic, but, you know, I watched Tyler Zeller a lot last year, and he's going to be a solid backup big man for his career, but really that's about it. I mean, so yeah, there's a lot of little things like that. The Syracuse Indiana game, I mean, if you go and watch that game, I don't know how you're not terrified of Cody Zeller after that. I mean, that was – he didn't even look like a D-League prospect in that game. It was so bad.
Yeah, but Syracuse's whole defense is focused on smashing big men. And you got – I mean, so I don't know. I don't know how much I love that whole water for me.
Again, it's two guys that I don't think we're in love with. It's just for me, Len you know, sneaks above Zeller because I think it's pretty clear I'm a defensive first guy, and I don't see many 7-foot-1 guys with agility to play the pick and roll. So I love the possibility, of him pairing with Davis on the inside. But again, I'm not in love with either of these guys. The other curious thing is you had Trey Burke ahead of these two guys. I had him one spot behind these two guys. So you're saying if these three are the three left on the board, your top five go, you have Burke, Zeller, and Len sitting there. You would take Trey Burke.
I would take Trey Burke. I have him number 6 on my board, which means that if everybody was following the Schwann's book of draftees, the Pelicans should end up with Trey Burke. And I would be sad. But that's just because the five guys in front of him, I think, are better. So Burke has a lot of ability. He's a very good, I can't even say very good. He is good in the half court. His problems are mostly in the open court. but I've never seen Monty coach a team that cares about the open court. So I'm not really that worried about Burke not being able to, you know, fit into that open court game. So, I mean, Burke was very efficient as a shooter in the half court, and he was extremely efficient as a ball handler in the pick and roll. So at the very least, I could see him being a useful member of the rotation. Whether I think he'll remain a starter or become a starter full time or always be one of those fringe guys who maybe should or shouldn't be starter, I don't know. But right, I think Burke is better than Zeller or Len.
So let me tell you why I have him behind, and I'm not going to pretend like this is my theory. I heard it from a friend of mine that said that this was, you know, their basketball operations staffs. This was their theory, and it just made so much sense to me that I honestly stole it. He said, look around the league and look at how many point guards there are in this league. Like, we call it the era of the point guard, and we tend to think of the top six or eight guys. Yeah, there's a lot of great ones, but there's a lot of good ones too. Like, there's, you know, there's more starting caliber point guards in this league than there has ever been. And their belief is that if you can't get one of those game changers, that it's such a buyer's market for all these middle guys. I mean, you know, you have backups who are starting quality point guards. You look at a guy like Reggie Jackson in OKC. You look at, obviously, Eric Bledsoe with the Clippers. Jarrett Jack came off the bench. Andre Miller came off the bench. You know, there's you could say that there's 35, 40 starting caliber point guard. I mean, you could probably get Darren Collison for peanuts this offseason. So the point just was that, you know, if you're not getting one of those top guys, then, or a guy that you think could be a top guy, then you just get by with a six or a seven for now until something presents itself, because there's so many of them out there. And you go ahead and you spend your draft pick or your money on somebody who's a game changer in another area and build up your team that way. That, you know, there's so many sixes out there that you don't want to use a valuable resource to get a seven. So that was kind of this philosophy. It just made a lot of sense to me. I look at Trey Burke. Do I honestly believe that he could get into those top tiers where, you know, he goes up against, forget even the elite ones, he goes up against John Wall or Kyrie Irving, and we say, oh, that's an even matchup. No, I don't think he could get there. I think he could get to the point where, you know, maybe he wins the matchup against Mo Williams on a given night, or maybe he's equal to I can't even say Drew Holiday. Like, I'm trying to think of, you know, a Jameer Nelson. Like, maybe he plays to a draw with that, but I could get that so many other places. Why am I going to use a valuable resource, a sixth pick, when this league is just so loaded at the point guard position right now? There's more coming out next year. There's, you know, probably seven that are going to be drafted this year. I mean, the point guards just keep coming in and in and in and in. If I can't get an 8, 9, or a 10, I'm honestly not using a significant resource to get a point guard. So that's why Burke is lower for me.
I gotcha. And you think Zeller and Len are more likely to give you that 8, 9, or 10 possibility?
No, I think that when you look at the shooting guard, small forward, power forward, center position, it's not as loaded. So I think it drops a lot more significantly. So even if Zeller, so let's say a world where Burke, Zeller, and Lynn all turn out to be sevens, right, there's way more 7 and 6 point guards than there are 6 and 7 big men
centers
that I would be able to get. If I want a 6 or a 7 big man, I'm going to have to pay $8 million a year. So,
right.
So at that point, it just becomes a numbers game. The last guy, well, there's one more you have in here, but a guy that you have in here, he's obviously in my tier one, but talk to Pelicans fans, because if it were up to you and both guys were on the board, you would take C.J. McCollum over Trey Burke. Why?
Without even hesitating. So, like, this, honestly, I have Burke, Zeller, and Len in the same tier as McCollum and Knoll. But to be fair, they should really be tier two. Those other guys should be tier three and then tier four after that for me. Because I think that there is a extreme drop-off after McCollum. So McCollum is – he is just a natural scorer. And first, I didn't want to think about McCollum in that light. I thought that he had only played 12 games this year. It was fluke. There's no way that he could ever shoot the way he had for this season. I mean, we've seen, you know, we've been fooled by, you know, Aminu for a dozen games where we thought he was turning the corner, and then suddenly he falls off the cliff again. So saying that McCollum was going to be great because of 12 games is silly. But when you look at what he did last year, he was pretty damn amazing then too. And this is a guy who had all of the offense on him and still was unbelievably efficient as a scorer, a shooter, a ball handler in the half court, in the open court. The guy just has a lot of natural talent as a scorer. Is he a point guard? No, I don't think so. Could he be a more basketball savvy version of Jamal Crawford? Absolutely. This is a guy whose basketball IQ is better than Crawford's ever was. And Crawford is a guy who wins six man awards. So I absolutely love the idea of McCollum as a off-the-bench spark plug, or if you need him to be a really dynamic scorer in a three-guard set.
And see, I think you and I are really comfortable with this. My feeling from my interactions or just reading – you know, people who read our site or people who tweet me, people are terrified when I can't tell them what position a guy is. Like, that's the number one question all the time with every player. Can Anthony Bennett play small forward? Can Oladipo play small forward? Is McLemore just a shooting guard, or can he play that? Like, I don't know how we rid ourselves of people's obsessions with positions, but they're real. But I don't know what else to point to other than, again, I think every one of our listeners and readers watched the NBA Finals, at least parts of it. You know, what position did Danny Green play in that series? I mean, I don't know. I really don't know how to get people over this fear anymore. I don't know what position McCollum plays. I think he is a much better shooting version of Jarrett Jack when he reaches his peak. I don't know what position Jarrett Jack played this year, but he was very effective in the five-man units when he was on the floor with Steph Curry and Klay Thompson were amazing. Who played point guard? Who played shooting guard? Who played small forward? I have no clue who played what position when those guys were out there, but they were very effective, and really that's all that matters and all that we should be talking about. I wish we talked about skill sets more than this old, archaic idea of positions.
Yeah, and he's a guy who can play both your wing as a primary ball handler, just the way Eric Gordon was this year. I mean, honestly, I don't think they're that different of players, except that Gordon goes to the basket a little bit more and McCollum would be a better shooter. And, I mean, I think you mentioned this before. I mean, McCollum's numbers, even last year, shooting off the dribble are insane.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen a guy with those kinds of numbers in, like, college or pro.
Yeah.
He's absolutely a guy I would love to have.
For some reason, he's still number five on your board, so I got to hear about these guys who you have better than him, starting with the last guy in your tier two, Nerlens Noel. I guess my question is, why is he in your tier two?
So because of his floor is so low for me. I mean, I could really honestly see this guy enter the NBA and do a Thabeat.
Mm.
I think he's clearly more athletic than Thabeat. And he has certain skills you can latch onto. You can say his shot blocking to personal foul ratio is amazing. And I mean, you can, I mean, that's what we were latching onto last year with Anthony Davis is one of the things. But Noel is just, he's a bad rebounder. He's got no offensive game really at all. He could pass a little bit, but then last year we were saying Anthony Davis was an amazing passer because we were watching him do entry passes to Kid Gilchrist, and Davis isn't showing much passing ability out there. That was more of the offense and what he was supposed to be doing. So I just see he's so skinny. I don't see him as being able to be an amazing basketball player necessarily. I could just see him really be gone in 2 years as completely useless. I mean, Joe Smith was taken number one overall, and the guy was a beanpole, and he got huge contracts, but he never was that effective of a basketball player.
Yeah, and that way, and what's even worse is some of the guys drafted behind him in that draft, because there were some Hall of Famers taken after him. I mean, Nerlens Noel, he's obviously in my first tier only because again, if we valued defense the way we valued offense, everybody would be in love with him. I think you're being a little unfair to Noel and Len when you say they're bad or horrible rebounders. I would say they're average. If you look at their numbers pace per 40, I mean, they're not at the bottom. They're typically right in the middle for their position. I think bad is a strong word.
I like to compare them against like past rebounders that we've seen that have come out and been really good rebounders.
Right.
I don't see them as ever. From what they've shown in college, I would never be comfortable saying that guy is a threat to lead the league in rebounding. They'll never do that.
Right. But not leading the league. I'm just saying your adjective bad is not.
Okay.
A bad rebound.
Like, that's fair.
Yeah, like Robin Lopez is a bad defensive rebounder. They will never be that. I could see Alex Len being like Roy Hibbert. Roy Hibbert isn't bad. I would say he's average for, you know, maybe slightly below average. But I, when I think of bad, I think of Robin Lopez or Ryan Anderson in the defensive glass.
Comforting, isn't it?
Yeah. So I don't think they're bad. So, all right, so that's our tier two, which means you have three guys in your top tier, which, you know, I'm assuming that if any of these guys get pick six, you will be giddy as a schoolgirl on draft night. So take me through your 1, 2, 3 on your big board.
Well, first, we got to say something about your big board. Because you have two guys in your tier one that aren't in my tier one at all, so I guess we'll start. Your number four is the same as my number three, which is McLemore.
Yeah, we have the same top five. We just have them in different order.
Right. So I mean, McLemore, he's the one who's supposedly been poor in workouts and is slipping. So, and he's the guy that we didn't even have in the six-pick tournament because there's no way this guy was going to slip. So I have an NBA player comparison I really love for McLemore. I know people are trying to do the Ray Allen thing, and I think that's just more people never realizing that Ray Allen was a 25-5-5 guy during his prime.
Yeah,
I mean, Ray Allen was insanely good.
He could make plays for himself and others. McLemore has shown nothing to make us believe he could do that.
Right. So McLemore, you have him at 4. I have him at 3. If he slips and the Pelicans take him, are you ecstatic? Do we have a potential all-star on our hands?
I think he would be better suited coming here than he would most other places. I think that he has to be a guy that he can't be the star. If he goes to Charlotte, his career is screwed. Like, there's just no way you could put the ball in his hands and ask him to go out and score or even be the guy on the cover of your media guy, the guy selling tickets or whatever, I think, you know, he is a great complimentary scorer. Again, that is the type of guy that could make all-star teams if he's on a good team where a lot of other people are drawing attention and he's able to, you know, just kind of do his thing, kind of like Rip Hamilton. Rip Hamilton had so, I mean, he wasn't great in other places. Nobody was, you know, championing him to be an all-star. Then all of a sudden in Detroit, he has a great low post scorer in Rasheed Wallace. He has Chauncey running the show. He has Ben Wallace on the back line kind of helping him whenever somebody gets by him. He's got Tayshaun doing isolations and also playmaking. Like, that was a great situation for Rip Hamilton. I think Ben McLemore could be a similar player where if he's not asked to do too much, and this is ironic, you're not asking him to do too much, but he could be your leading scorer. Just like Rip Hamilton, he was their leading scorer. They didn't really ask him to do too much. It seems weird, but I think that's McLemore's ideal situation, and if he gets in that ideal situation, he could be a multi-time All-Star.
And, I mean, I do believe that he could develop a more complete offensive skill set where he could become a more primary ball handler. I don't think he's anywhere near that right now. So here's my comparison for McLemore. Jason Richardson. So Jason Richardson went to Golden State. He did average 20 points a game for a lot of his time there. The man, he could drill threes really well. He was an unbelievable shooter. He stayed in the league for a long time because of that. And his athletic ability was off the charts. His dunks were amazing. But if you went and asked any Golden State Warrior fan, what did they hate to see Jason Richardson do? It was put the ball on the floor and dribble more than a couple times when he wasn't on a breakaway. Because you didn't think anything great was going to come of it. He could dribble in a straight line, and if anything tried to stop him, he was not an offensive great. He wasn't going to be able to do much for you. And I think that's what McLemore is. Right now, he doesn't have the ability to create for other people. He can't dribble super well. He's not a great ball handler. He's got some slashing ability, but mostly he's an open court player and a guy who can burn people off of broken plays, show amazing athleticism sometimes, and drill the threes on the perimeter at any time.
Yeah, I think that's a great comparison, and that even you could even tie that back to what I said, because yeah, Jason Richardson, when he had that team around him, he had that magical year in Golden State. Then what happens? They trade him to the Bobcats for the 8th pick, and now all of a sudden Charlotte's hoping that he comes in to be their 20-point scorer, their main go-to guy, and he just starts falling apart at that point.
Yeah, he can't do it.
Yeah, so, and see, this is where I just think it's a little unfair because some guys we give the benefit of the doubt and others we don't. I mean, you said you think that McLemore could probably develop that in-between game, but why? I mean, so for those of you who didn't see, we actually put McLemore in the finals of the 6-pick tournament, kind of Daniel LaRusso from Karate Kid 3 style, where he didn't have to do anything. He just got entered straight into the finals because he does obviously look like he's in play. And when I went back and dug through the research, this guy, of all the shooting guard prospects in this year's draft, dead last in his isolation ratio. Second to last in pick and roll. So he's not average or below average in these categories. He is literally the worst prospect in these two areas where people create offense for themselves in the entire draft. Guys who are going to be picked 40th or maybe even undrafted shooting guards. I mean, if we're saying that he could improve in that, then why not give everybody in the prospect in this draft the benefit of the doubt that they could improve in their worst areas? So that's where I just think it's unfair. When you try to like a guy, you're just going to say, oh, well, he could improve there. Well, then give everybody the benefit of the doubt is my point. So I'm not confident that McLemore will ever develop that in-between game. I like Jason Richardson as a ceiling, and I could see a more athletic Danny Green as kind of his floor, and you see what you know, could happen to Danny Green in a seven-game series once a team gets locked in on him. So, I mean, he's in my tier one, mostly because this is a pretty weak draft, but he's at the bottom of my tier one. He's fourth for me.
Yeah, and I have him third. I'm not, like, that much higher on him than you are. Basically, we swapped Noel and McLemore.
Yeah.
So, do you want to say anything more about Noel? I mean, there's a lot of rumors out there about his personal life that, I mean, I don't know anything about it, but some of them are kind of scary.
Yeah, if you want to, there's a seven-page article in the New York Times. I mean, I feel guilty sometimes when I put up a 3,000-word piece on Bourbon Street Shots. I feel like people aren't going to even read it. This was a seven-page piece, so... If you've got a Tuesday to kill, go ahead and read it. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there that worries you. But again, if you look at these guys as commodities, prospects, guys with potential, I would have him third on my list. If my top two guys are gone, I take him, and I wouldn't be that worried about it.
So are you saying you take him so you can move him? Or do you think there's any chance Noel and Davis could play together in any sort of long-term front court?
I think there's a chance that they could play together. I love the idea of having those two guys on the court because I could be so aggressive in my pick and roll defense. Like imagine a team goes pick and roll the guy who Noel is covering. Is setting the pick. I could have Noel hedge hard all the way out on the guard, be really aggressive in trapping that ball, and even if they swing it out, I got Anthony Davis there patrolling the paint, and I know Noel could sprint and with his wingspan get back and alter a shot. And my pick and roll defense with those two guys, I think, would be absolutely amazing. So I think there would be a possibility of holding on to both of them. But no, I would take him at that point just because I think he would be the guy with the most value. And somewhere down the line, you know, I could get something good if I move him.
All right. So here's where people are going to, like, think you're crazy. So we're now at our top two. For those of you who are keeping track, we'll just say our top two, so we don't say number two, and then everybody's like, oh, obviously number one is. So, drum roll, your number two is...
C.J. McCollum?
C.J. McCollum, my number five. And my number two is Victor Oladipo, my number one being Otto Porter, and you have Oladipo number one.
Yeah, I mean...
So basically, you pull McCollum way up high, and I pull Porter way up high. But both of us agree Oladipo is definitely one of the top two players in this league.
Yeah.
Or draft, not league. But
yeah, and it was just solidified for me today. I mean, I've had Oladipo number one since the beginning of this whole draft process. I just think I think combination of what he has now plus the ceiling – plus how, you know, he would fit in to the Pelicans culture. And just, I mean, honestly, the type of guys that I really like in this type of process are the guys like Oladipo, because I can't see any way that he possibly fails, barring, of course, injury, but that goes for any of these guys. I don't know how he possibly fails. And again, go read on ESPN. Brian Windhorst did a great two-part piece on the oral history of the 2003 draft. SportsCenter ran a great little documentary about it. Read and watch and listen to everything people were saying about Dwayne Wade in 2003, and then read, watch, and listen to what people are concerned about with Oladipo and what they say his strengths are, conversely. I'm not saying they're going to be the same guy, but if there's anybody in this draft that has the potential to be a multiple-time All-Star, a guy who's consistently the best player in a series, he is the only one I could possibly see. I mean, in this entire draft, we're talking about the playoffs. Can you see anybody else in this draft being the best player in a series in the playoffs?
McCollum?
Yeah, I could see him.
If you're looking purely scoring, yeah, that's about it.
I could see him having a Curry type series. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah, and that's why they're my one and two. Oladipo and McCollum are the only two guys I think. Again, we haven't tasted the playoffs in a while, so we're all thinking regular season. People ask, can he score 17 and six assists? And I guess I don't really care about that anymore. I'm trying to think about if and when we get to the playoffs. You know, I just watched the playoffs. I was just captivated by it. And you see the kind of guys that rise, and you see the guys who shrink with the bright lights. To me, those are the only two guys who, you know, could just go into a series and be the best player coming out of it. So that's why they're on top of my big board.
Yeah, so for both Oladipo and Porter, for me, part of the reason why they're at the very top is not only just that they've shown me that they can do a lot of things at a very high level, is both of them have actually proven to me that they can improve from season to season, where some of these other guys, they're not improving very much, or if they improve, it's like a real marginal improvement. Go take a look at Oladipo's numbers as from freshman to sophomore to junior, and they're crazy. This guy works like a dog, and it's not one of those situations either where, you know, he got better and then you're like questioning his numbers. His numbers are very high this year, and maybe you should question them, but he got better every year he's improved. So it's not like he got better and then fell back down to earth. He got better, and then he got better again. That's kind of the mark of somebody who actually is working on his game and learning and improving it and becoming a better basketball player. It's not the mark of somebody who just had a fluke season. And Porter's in the same boat. The only reason why I have Porter higher than Oladipo, because really in my world, they're 1A, 1B. It's so close for me and so hard for me to differentiate. Porter just checks a few more boxes for me than Oladipo does. I think Oladipo is better defensively and has a higher motor, but I watch Porter, and this is what kind of sold me. When you watch his tapes, he is most effective when he's catching the ball in that same thing I mentioned before, right there at the elbow, where he can actually face up and be something kind of dangerous. He can move across the paint. He can move towards the basket. He can fade away. He can hit cutters. He's a guy you could actually have in the high post, and you could run offense around, and he would be a benefit for you. And Oladipo isn't that level of offensive good. He's definitely defensive good in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, he isn't there yet. But again, if we're talking about his work ethic and we believe it is what the urban legends and the stories say it is, then, you know, he'll get there and beyond. But what I will say, that the one thing that I really like about Otto Porter that I don't really think gets a lot of play is that he was actually really good in transition. The problem is,
yeah,
Georgetown never got out in transition, but he scored 1.45 points per possession in transition.
Yeah.
I mean, that's leading, you know, the guys in the wing, the small forwards, that leads every prospect coming out this year. Like, he was really good there. So I know we say that the Pelicans don't get out in transition. That doesn't mean that they never will. But, you know, I think Georgetown and their system and the way that he played in it actually hit a lot of things about him that could be really good. So I could see him having some potential that hasn't been realized yet, that we see when he gets in the NBA, just because he gets out of Georgetown's system, which is very slow, very deliberate. You know, it helps him develop an IQ and a team-first mentality, but I think that system might have limited him. So I could see Porter really bursting out, too, once you get into the pros and you just kind of say, hey, where'd this come from?
Right. Yeah, so Oladipo-wise, I mean, you got him number one. I got him number two. I mean, what is it about Oladipo, other than his improvement, that makes you just I mean, cause I'm assuming you think that there's no way he's going to fail. What is his floor for you?
Man, I would say floor would be that same kind of Tony Allen, Avery Bradley that we see on defense, and on offense, floor Ronnie Brewer in Utah when he was actually, you know, good and pretty. He wasn't hitting shots, but he was always running that baseline. He was always getting offensive rebounds and cheap buckets and stuff like that. I think even if he never develops that knockdown outside shot, I think that anytime his defender takes a peek at the ball, he's running backdoor for an alley-oop or putting back an offensive rebound. Like I think he'll get 12 to 15 points a game that way, you know, in a very efficient way. He'll also get to the line. He'll also be a beast in transition, and then he'll play that defense. I think that's his absolute floor is Ronnie Brewer on offense and in Utah and like a Tony Allen on defense.
Right. Yeah.
So here's my question. We both have him 1-2, you know, 1-2. You have Porter up there. We're sitting here at 6. You have 3 guys in your top tier, 2 of which sounds like they're even higher than the third. What's the maximum you would give up to ensure that you get one of those guys on the top tier of your big board?
So basically you're asking what would I give up to move to number 2?
Yeah, to be guaranteed. Let's just say I could guarantee you anybody in this draft.
Okay.
Whether that's 1 or 2, I mean, because let's say Alex Len goes number 1, then you only have to trade up to 2. But what's the absolute most you would give up to make sure that you get one of these guys who you have head and shoulders above the rest?
I mean, I would probably consider next year's draft pick in anything. I mean, when you say what's the most I would give up, probably in my world, the best package I would put on the table is number 6 with a 2014 protected top, like, 4 pick, and Vasquez or Lopez, take your pick.
What about, I mean, we're going into the summer of flexibility. What about taking on bad contracts? Is that worse for you or better? I mean, so you look at Orlando. Orlando's got Al Harrington. They got Big Baby Davis. They have a couple of contracts that I'm sure they would like to shed. Hedo Turkoglu, would you take on one of those contracts in order to move up and get one of these guys and possibly kill all the flexibility you have this summer to move up to get one of those guys?
Yeah, though I'd think very hard about it for a while. Yeah, I mean, so the flexibility is nice, but we're going to have the flexibility back again next year, honestly, if we do it that way. I would just basically consider this the only way we're going to become a team that actually competes is if we grab veterans with that open money. So if I do that, if I make that decision, I have to make myself comfortable with the idea that I am not going to be contending seriously for any sort of playoff spot with that trade.
And see, I get this argument, but I mean, Dylan Monty came out very clearly at the beginning of last year and said that this summer is when we're going to get our guys and move forward. And yeah, I guess you could delay it another year, but I mean, it's more than just getting players. You got to start building chemistry and guys have to start knowing how to play together. You can't just keep recycling people through. And the longer we put off, okay, this is the off season where we get our core team together and then push forward. Oh, no, okay, we'll take on this Sean Marion contract or this Hedo Turkoglu contract for 1 year in order to get excess asset. And then it'll come off the books next year, and then we'll get that core guy. Like, the longer you put that off, then that's just another year it's going to take of guys learning how to play together and develop that chemistry. Like, the quicker you could get to that, you know, I think we all look at guys and their skills and we say, oh, this is how good a team could be. you know, the longer a team plays together, there's just kind of a variable that you can't measure that kind of helps them take off. I mean, I look at that Dallas team, and yeah, they brought Chandler in late in the game, but so many of those guys had played together so long. That team on paper wasn't one of the top five teams in the NBA that year. But because they had played together so long and had that familiarity and knew each other's strengths and weaknesses and you know, built that together, they were able to win a championship. I don't think you could keep putting off getting this foundation in place more than anything, because you need guys, you know, learning how to play together and developing that chemistry.
So you're saying no, if Orlando calls you up and says, give us number six and you could have number two in Turkaloo, you'd say no?
It'd be tough, because then I'd really be screwed if the draft played out the other way and all I had left was Trey Burke or Anthony Bennett to choose between. Again, I would take CJ. I'm 100% sure McCollum's going to be there at six. So I would take him. So no, I would say no. But if you're telling me Dell's not going to take McCollum, you know, then it would be hard. I guess what I'm saying is I'd rather give up 2014, especially protected, or Lopez and or Vasquez. All those things I would offer first before offering to kill my financial flexibility. That would be my absolute last case resort.
Okay. What if whatever deal you make, as long as you can, you could still waive Lopez and be able to put like a $8 or $10 million deal out there. Is that enough, or do you really need the full flexibility, do you feel, for this offseason?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's what's going to be so interesting. There's so many teams with money. I don't even know. I don't know how it's going to play out. I don't know how many teams are really going to go for the tank with this 2014. Like, I'm so curious about Boston right now. I can't imagine them as the type of franchise that would tank, especially the last five, six seasons they're coming off of. But, you know, I think that this is an off season where you could get value after, you know, the big slew of guys go at the beginning, the same way we did with Ryan Anderson and Lopez. I mean, people are saying, oh, we're not going to get Iguodala. What does this cap space matter? We're not going to get anybody. We have the same amount of cap space right now as it took to get Ryan Anderson and Lopez last year. So how can you be so sure that we're not going to get anything when the same amount of money got us two very high-quality players relative to their salary last year? I mean, every single time you've given Dell the tiniest bit of flexibility, he's made an improvement to the roster. So I guess I trust him with that flexibility enough to where it would take a lot for me to kill it, because, you know, with that Okafor Ariza trade last year, he put himself in a beautiful position to have tons of options this off season to kill it, and to kill it especially for guys who have never played a minute in the league, that would just be hard for me to do.
Yeah. No, I gotcha. I agree. I probably would end up pulling the trigger if I could get one of my top couple guys, but it'd be tough.
Yeah, it would be tough to pass on Oladipo, right. But...
So we have a guest, but in order to listen to that guest, you will have to download part two of this podcast. It's absolutely worth it. Amin is one of my favorite guests we've ever had on this podcast. You should absolutely download part two and listen to it at your first opportunity. He has some fresh takes on some of these players that we talked about in this podcast. Enjoy! You all know,